Greetings, and welcome to Talking Who to You, a podcast dedicated to the Big Finish audio adventures of Doctor Who. My name is Kevin Kozer, and I'm here with my co-host, JG McQuarrie. Say hi, JG.
Hey there, Kevin. How are you doing this week?
Well, I think I'm doing fine, but if you find that I'm replaced with a madman who thinks he's me, then feel free to cut this off.
Well, so far that hasn't happened. Let's just wait and see how the podcast progresses. But as if that wasn't a subtle enough clue, well, that means that we are dealing with the first story in the Villains trilogy. So that means this week we're going to be dealing with Omega, and the next couple of weeks we're going to be doing Davros and Master. So what were your general impressions of Omega then, Kevin?
Well, I didn't remember much about Omega except the big twist, which, once we get the general impressions, is the first thing I want to talk about because it is probably the most famous and notable part of the story. But knowing the twist in advance really helped sort of enhance the murder mystery around it. It's a very well-constructed story. What I did not remember and think of less fondly, even though it does run it working its way sort of back into the story later, is some of the humor is a little much at points. But then I was also surprised by, all over again, the sort of themes about history and how you sort of create, like, historical versions of characters. And so, yeah, I found it a lot very fascinating. A story that I didn't really remember beyond this one thing is actually really interesting when you dig beneath it.
Yeah, I think there's an awful lot going on here, and it's certainly given us plenty to talk about sort of over the course of this podcast. But I suppose briefly we should sort of summarize the plot, which is, it's unconventional. Do you want to have a go at summarizing it?
Well, for three episodes, we follow the Doctor walking around trying to solve a murder mystery as these actors upon a ship that is reenacting sort of Omega's fateful trip into a black hole start being overtaken by madness, reenacting things from the event, and then as the people are murdered, the Doctor tries to figure out what's going on, and then the Doctor's also talking to Omega this whole time, and then we learn that the Doctor actually is Omega in a split personality, and the real Doctor arrives, and things get even more complicated from there.
Okay, that's a pretty good stab at it. I mean, it's not a particularly easy episode to summarize, I think.
I can't even begin to really summarize it, but now you know what we're talking about, at least, if you need some catching up and reminder.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, one of the things, we might as well talk about the big twist right off the bat, because that's really what the whole story kind of pivots around. So as you said, yeah, the big revelation that the character we've been following for three episodes and who we think is the Doctor actually turns out to be Omega. And it's one of those, it's really interesting kind of way of doing it, because it sort of structurally changes how this episode exists. So up until that point, we get the impression that it's a sort of a little bit of a lighthearted runaround at the start, and then we have the introduction of Omega, so things get a bit more serious, and so on. And then eventually we get this big twist at the end of episode three, the big episode three cliffhanger. And it sort of completely reframes everything that we've been listening to, and that it sort of transforms it into what is essentially a puzzle box episode. And, you know, puzzle box episodes tend to work in two modes. There's either the first one, which is trying to sort of figure out the rules of the puzzle and work out what's going on. So something like, say, Blink from the new series or Enlightenment from Davison's own era. And then there's this kind of puzzle box where you get that big kind of pivot about two-thirds of the way through or three-quarters of the way through, and that reframes everything you've watched and or listened to, and then sort of, you know, you then have to figure out how this is going to kind of draw itself to some kind of conclusion. And it's a doozy of a twist. There's no doubt about it. And I mean, if you've heard it more than once, there are tiny little hints, particularly sort of in episode three itself, but it's very, very muted. They do very little to kind of show the hand. But you've mentioned before in the podcast that you're quite a connoisseur of stories which have got sort of big twists and you know, sort of rely on that kind of narrative convention. So do you feel that the big twist works here? How do you think it works around that?
I honestly think the episode three cliffhanger might be the best. I almost want to go that far, but easily one of the best cliffhangers in Doctor Who history. I would say as far as like Big Finish's best cliffhanger, unless I'm forgetting a real doozy. I guess Jubilee had a couple, but yeah, it's so fantastic because, like I said, it really doesn't contradict what comes before, but reframes everything. It's such a genius little way, and it really sort of drives the story to a point where you weren't really expecting it. And I think that's what's really impressive, is that it has sort of constructed itself as this mystery, and then it narrows down these suspects, and then manages to find a suspect, an answer, rather, that is both entirely unexpected and yet fits so well with the story. And, like, stories that can do that always rank really high for me. That, like, it's almost impossible to guess, but yet the story couldn't have been told any other way. And I think this twist does that perfectly.
Okay, nice. I like the twist very much. I think it does an excellent job of reframing kind of the three episodes that you've listened to prior to, that we've listened to prior to that. I think it walks so close to the line of being like a Scooby-Doo reveal, and it kind of gets away with it, but it really walks right up to that line for me. But I do think it works very well, and I think one of the reasons it kind of is able to get away from that ta-da sort of Scooby-Doo moment is because it does such a good job of reframing everything else. I mean, there's some nice sound design in there as well, so when you get, especially once we sort of get into the fourth episode, and once we sort of get the Doctor and Omega's voices kind of flittering between each other, I think that's handled quite well, and it gives a lot of kind of credibility to this kind of split level personality. So I definitely do think that it works. I have a couple of points which we'll get to a little bit later on, where I think the play is maybe slightly less successful, but I think absolutely in the way that it's able to kind of pull off that kind of hairpin turn, and we've discussed in the show before many writers who have tried that kind of hairpin turn and sort of spectacularly flown off the cliff. So the fact that kind of Nev Fountain is able to land it here is a real credit to him, I think.
Yeah, I think the twist would be nearly as effective if it wasn't for the fact that it really does sort of, it adds so much to the story by making Omega this much more tragic figure, and like, the sort of warring personality really does shift sort of sympathy to him. Like, in a way that, I don't know, I think the story is sort of unexpected. And it's a real sort of throw line through all the villain stories. We'll talk about each one. They do a great job threading sympathy for the central character without ever letting them off the hook. And I almost said Omega does it the least successfully, and it still does a great job of that. It's a really fantastic way to sort of get us in this very bland character from the TV show. I hope I don't ruffle any Three Doctors mega fans' feathers by saying that. This very bland character from the TV show, and giving him much more depth and insight by having him play off the Doctor like this in these sort of mind conversations. And then you get to the real him, and he's just sort of this broken down, tragic figure. And especially in figuring the Centillions, which we'll talk about later, it's just a very sort of fascinating look at him.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I agree with you, by the way, when you say that this is probably the least of the three villains trilogies, and it's still very good. I think one of the little weeds that I would pull on here myself is that I do agree that Omega is sort of presented as this kind of this a broken figure. I'm not sure the script quite manages to land the psychological insight into the character in the same way that Davros and Master do. I'm not going to talk forward about them. We'll get there when we get there. But there is a couple of times in this where we just get people sort of outright described as, well, he's mad. And there's not a lot of attempt to sort of dig into the kind of psychological aspects there. I agree that the sort of tragedy of what happens to Omega, and the fact that it's his own ego and it's his own kind of self-inflicted sense of betrayal that leads him to his tragedy. I agree, all that stuff works. And I mean, this is unquestionably the best Omega story there is. I mean, that's yeah, again, I also don't want to upset any Three Doctors fans, or indeed the two people who might not have outright contempt for Arc of Infinity. But, you know, this is by far and away the best attempt to do something with Omega. And I give so much credit to trying to put some kind of life into a character who was every bit as cardboard as the helmet that he wore. And it's just a shame, I think, that that it's a little bit off-handed with those little, yeah, but he's mad. And I wish that there had been a bit more about that, or like blaming dimensional instabilities in the region of space does like weird things to people. That's like, I mean, I get it within a Doctor Who context, but I feel that, the story doesn't need that. One of the criticisms that I definitely have of Omega is that I think it's too long. This doesn't need to be 2 hours and 20 minutes long, especially the first episode, I think, is massively too long. I think we could have done without some of that material, or used that space to maybe actually spend time exploring what it is that drives Omega to his madness beyond the usual kind of, oh, he thinks he's been betrayed, or oh, he has a lust for power, or whatever. But what do you think? You think that part of the play lands?
First one, back up a bit. Ark of Infinity, great shopping scene with the Doctor and Nyssa. Only nice thing I can say about it. As far as Omega's length, it sort of sets up a challenge for itself that doesn't overcome, where that massive twist needs to be the episode 3 cliffhanger, sort of by design. You can have it in the middle of an episode that's insane, and to put it even earlier in the story would just be sort of weirdly structuring it. So you need the episode 3 cliffhanger, but there's so much to resolve afterwards when the actual Doctor comes in and has to clean up the mess. And so, yeah, there's no real way around it. I mean, oh, I guess they could have cut, like, yeah, you have to cut stuff, basically. You have to either cut out a lot of, like, sort of senses into the madness, cut out the flashback stuff, cut out maybe some of the stuff with Maven. And it's, all of that feels necessary, even if not all of that is spectacular, you know? Like, you miss some of that, and then it feels even more sort of shaky. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I don't know what I would do instead.
Well, the thing is that these episodes are not equal length, and that's quite an unusual conceit for Big Finish at this point in its history as well. So episode 3 is pretty short. I think it is like 28 or 29 minutes long, but we also have episode 4 is 45 minutes long.
Yeah.
So they do go for that, you know, those differing lengths of episodes, and that's fine. I think it's particularly, I find episode 1 really a bit of a struggle this time round, and I don't want to say that Doctor Who stories can't be that long. They definitely can. For me, The War Games is a top 5 story of all time, and you know, it's 10 episodes long. So it's not like I don't think Doctor Who can do stories of this length, but there's just so much padding in that first episode. It's a very kind of mild sort of satire on television, but it's made kind of all the points it really needs to make by about the 5 minute mark, and it kind of leaves us languishing for about half an hour waiting for a cliffhanger to turn up. And by the time it does, that's fine, and everything sort of going forward from that is fine, but it's just this episode doesn't need to be that length. So I think I agree with you with when it comes to all the stuff about Sentia's sort of descent into madness and all the stuff with Professor Exus and Lufus and all that stuff. That's fine. That can all stay. But I think a lot of that kind of episode 1 stuff could just go, and some of the other episodes. You're right. That big cliffhanger has to be the episode 3 cliffhanger. But those first two episodes could be tightened up a fair bit, I think, to the benefit of the play.
That's true. I think that's something I've seen with Big Finish before, and this sort of goes to it, but again, you have sort of long episodes, so... But see, like, a story worth, like, 3 25-minute episodes and then a 45-minute episode. I don't know if I've seen a Big Finish that lopsided, but it could actually really work for the story. Because you're right, as fascinating as I find the ideas here presented about how, like, history is almost becoming more exciting when it's made up, and this sort of almost dystopic view of how we start to view record like that, I find it fascinating. But yeah, they do hit it a lot, and it does get a little tiresome, especially, like, I think I'm on the sort of warmer aspect to those aspects. Even I think it went on a little long. So yeah, it's could use some tightening up. Yeah. Especially when there's a lot of, like, Delon and Erectus just sort of wandering about. We get a lot of those scenes. That's, I think, my big bugbear.
Yeah, that's what I would agree with.
I think that maybe ties back to my biggest weed, which is the Scintillans, which feels like such a extraneous subplot until the very end. And so in the very end, when you reveal the Scintillans are actually a race the Doctor murdered and not Omega, like, then it becomes, though, very interesting that then it's sort of a contrast between them, and it's a really fascinating point that Omega makes the Doctor be the worst person because the Doctor handles the guilt better than Omega can. And so it raises this question, and I'm on the Doctor's side here, but it's interesting the way it's a question of whether if you feel how much guilt you feel over something is how noble you are, how sort of virtuous you are about this sort of dilemma. And like I said, I'm on the doctor's side. I don't think Omega's a better person for prostrating himself over it more. But yeah, it's a very fascinating idea it brings up that up until that point, the story is just using, oh, the Centillans. What about the Centillans? What are the Centillans? And it's just babbling on about them without giving us any details for those first three episodes. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair criticism as well. And I think there needs to be more of a kind of thematic link with them, because when it's finally revealed that the Doctor is the one that wiped them out in error, I mean, that feels like a twist that could work. And you know, especially kind of within this trilogy, there's a real sense of questioning the Doctor's sort of status as an unambiguous hero. And I think of all of them, I think Master probably lands it the best. But there's a similar theme that runs through all three of these stories. And that's good. That's a really worthwhile thing for these stories to be sort of analyzing and trying to take apart. I do think that the idea that he's able to cope with the guilt better, I mean, that feels consistent with the character of the Doctor, and the fact that Omega's a bit of a ranting loony feels consistent with his character. So it's understandable that these two characters react to the same thing in very different ways. So that's, I was going to make a point there. I've kind of got away from it a bit. But, I've completely forgotten what I was going to say, but I will make another point, which is, I think one of the things that does help to land that kind of episode four guilt that the Doctor is going through and the way that he's able to sort of deal with it is that it draws out an absolutely phenomenal performance from Peter Davison. He's really good in that. I mean, he's good across the whole thing. It's a really, really strong performance from him. I think not one of the ones that often gets talked about is one of his strongest performances, but I thought he's really consistently brilliant here, especially that sort of shift from the kind of light kind of comedy that Nev Fountain writes to him, sort of through to this kind of much more darker, much more sort of thematically rich material sort of in episode four. And yeah, I think Davison's performance helps to bridge that kind of gap a little bit.
Nev Fountain, I don't know if he's ever written for the Fifth Doctor again. I know why he often writes for the Sixth Doctor, and if you don't know, look up who he's in a relationship with, hopefully still with. But yeah, I think this might be the only Fifth Doctor story, and it's a shame because Davison delivers that sort of trademark Fountain bon mot so well. And I just love how dry his delivery on some of these are. And like, they can be very obnoxiously in your face at some times when Nev Fountain or another big Finnish writer is trying to step up and write a very funny script. Humor is far from one of Big Finish's strong suits. It's going to be very gentle around it. But this is one where it really works, I think. Maybe a little much at times, but when it works, it really does work, because I think it all comes from the Davison sort of great dry delivery.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's very easy to forget that Davison is actually a very gifted comic actor. He's done so many like sitcoms and, of course, Very Peculiar Practice, which was this kind of weird, dark comedy kind of thing. So he's able to land that register very well. And although I find some of the humor elsewhere a bit shaky in places, again, especially in episode one, where the satire, even calling it satire, feels like I'm greatly overstating it. Mild jabs might be a better description. But even then, you know, I mean, they're okay, but they go on far too long. But he is able to strike that sort of balance with Davison very, very well. And he writes very well for Davison's Doctor, which is, yeah, like you saying, comedy is not one of Big Finish's strong points. And I'm, of course, in agreement with that. But for some reason, it's brought to mind Fanfare for the Common Man, Common Men. And it's just not funny, but it's trying to do the same kind of thing with Davison's Doctor, but Nev Fountain is much, much better at it, and that's kind of the key thing. But importantly, he's able to do that kind of darker stuff as well. So when it comes to having the tonal shift between the sort of lightness and then the kind of more sort of thematically dark stuff that lies at the heart of the Doctor, he's able to write it in a way that allows Davison to make that tonal shift, and that takes some skill.
Oh, for sure. And like, even when the comedy is bad, I find it interesting. Every sort of element sort of winds up tying into the story in a much deeper way. Between like the light satire, like you said, it's hardly a satire. It's very mild, but it is still part of the overall thematic arch of like how history remembers people and how it can be sort of corrupted just for populist reasons. And then you have, which reminds me of the comedic low point, are Maven and Glinda, the two sort of daft tourists sort of wandering around and getting lost. And the one part I think that works is the little scene where they're locked up in a cabinet, and then they play fifth dimensional cribbage because they just don't care about their surroundings that little. That, I think, is a little funny. But the rest is just sort of hacky stuff. But then you get the twist at the end where Maven is a Time Lord and Glinda is her TARDIS, and they've been monitoring the situation the whole time, which isn't quite square with how they've been acting before at all, really. But still, it gets you a great scene out of it where they talk about how the Doctor needs to be remembered as this hero and Omega needs to be a villain because that's so much simpler for people to understand and process. And that's such a fascinating point to bring up. And it does, I don't know, I just sort of love that sort of complexity it goes for.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to see those little ideas starting to seep in. So the idea that one of the characters is a TARDIS feels very much like it's been, I don't want to say lifted, that sounds too pejorative, but it's certainly an idea which was explored in the Eighth Doctor adventures with a compassion arc. And so it's nice, I think it's interesting to see those ideas kind of starting to percolate through into the mainstream, especially because the sort of Eighth Doctor range is not widely held up as one of the great pinnacles of Doctor Who. So yeah, it's...
I just want to stop you for a second. You said something that came from a BBC-published book is now percolating into the mainstream, published by Big Finish, a completely separate company. And you're not wrong!
I do realize how weird that sounds. But it isn't. The Eighth Doctor range was always the kind of, you know, the orphan child of Doctor Who. The new adventures have the big reputation as the sort of dramatic push forward from what the TV show can do. The Eighth Doctor adventures are kind of forgotten, and then the show comes back on TV in 2005. So yeah, it's a really it's very timey-wimey, how typically Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But it is, yeah, they're about as not mainstream as a big chunk of Doctor Who can do. Big Finish is much more mainstream than the Eighth Doctor adventures.
And I mean, but, one of them is canon for the TV show, and it's Big Finish, which is very funny to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. But anyway, sort of moving on. Yeah, I think the idea that the way that history is perceived and the way that history is kind of played around with here in terms of its perception is another one of the strengths that it has here. And there's this expression, heritage theme park history, which I think was Lawrence Miles and Tat Wood from the About Time books. I think they were the first to come up with it. If they weren't, they were certainly the ones to popularize it. And it's this idea that whenever the Doctor goes back to sort of English history or British history or whatever, it's this sort of theme park version of it. And we've talked about this on the podcast before. So if you're talking about Peter Davison era, you're talking about something like Black Orchid. Or if you're talking about the TV show, you're talking about such deathless works of art as Shakespeare Code or something like that. And it's really interesting to see the Time Lord's history be portrayed in that kind of heritage theme park mode. It's not something that we're used to. Generally speaking, that expression, heritage theme park history, is one which is pejorative. People use it as a stick to beat it with. Like Mark of the Rani is kind of like a big classic example of it. And it's because it's very surface. It just deals with the details, the bits you might recognize if you've watched an episode of Upstairs, Downstairs, or whatever. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And it's really interesting to have Time Lord history kind of reconceptualized in that same heritage theme park way. It suggests that Nev Fountain has a very good understanding of the way that history operates and the way that we interpret history through the lens of how we experience it. So through visitor parks, through attractions, through tour guides, through all these ways that we find to process history without really necessarily having any depth or understanding to what it is we're being shown. And yeah, I think it's fascinating to see Time Lord history reframed that way. And some of it's a bit cheesy, you know, the Predonian pantry and stuff like that. But, you know, it's not completely an unfair way of saying it. You do get that kind of sort of cheesiness when you go to, you know, great stately homes or cathedrals or something like that. It's not inconsistent with the thing that's being discussed. So, yeah, I do like the way that history is portrayed in such a reduced way, and how by reducing history to those kind of talking points, to those tick box exercises, we lose something of the essence of history and why it's important in the first place.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah, I think that's what really gives the story a bit of a kick, because it must be so hard to write a story about Omega, like we've been talking about. I was engaging here on TV. So does it turn it into, like, because Omega is such a surface-level character, it almost feels like what we've seen on TV is just, like, the stories about him. It's not really getting into him as a person at all. So it's such a great trick of the story, is to find depth in Omega by leaning into the fact that his depiction on TV is so shallow, and sort of finding some sort of tragedy by the fact that that shallowness is all he'll be remembered of in Doctor Who fans. That sort of meta-text is something I really caught on to really well.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it suggests a really sort of smart understanding that Neve Fountain has of the way that fans view their own series and the way that we look at the history of the show as well. So if you're talking about sort of something like the Three Doctors, or if we have to, Arc of Infinity, we know that, I mean, even just saying it that way, you know, I take a big breath and a sigh before I say Arc of Infinity, because we're used to the, sort of that prism of viewing those stories through the lens of condemnation. Particularly the Three Doctors certainly has its defenders, but almost nobody is prepared to go to bat for Arc of Infinity. And, you know, so, you know, we already have those kind of setups in place. And by understanding the way that we also view the history of the show as a sort of paratextual thing, as well as the history of the characters within the show itself, a metatextual thing, it becomes, you know, a really sort of sly way of dealing with the character. And I think it's really important here as well that it's Ian Collier who comes back to play Omega. I mean, of all the terrible, awful missteps of Arc of Infinity, I don't think anybody really thinks that the casting of Ian Collier was one of them. He's generally pretty good. He's able, even in Arc of Infinity, he's able to give Omega, I don't want to say dimension, that's overstating it, I think, but he does slightly underplay it a little bit, and that helps to make Omega a little bit more credible as a villain. And for all Arc of Infinity's mistakes, you know, his motivation there, just wanting to come back to the universe, is not a difficult one to understand, and that's fine. Yeah, Collier's not a bad actor at all. But, you know, when you come from, like, you know, Stephen Thorne's performance, which is, you know, it's about as far from subtle as, you know, it's for the Brian Blessed School of Gentle Understatement. And yeah, it's, again, Stephen Thorne isn't a bad actor, but he's somebody who needs to be cast in the right role, and Omega wasn't that role. He's fine as Azal and the Daemons. He's absolutely fine, because Azal was just this big sort of bellowing demon, and Stephen Thorne is good at that. That's perfectly fine. But casting him as Omega sort of drained a lot of the pathos and a lot of the loss from the character in The Three Doctors, I think. So we, instead of getting this sort of sympathetic, slightly broken character, we get a big bellowing loony in a cardboard mask. And Collier's a big improvement from that. And I think the way that we view the show, that movement from sort of Thorne's version of it to Collier's, suggests an improvement in the way that the character can work. And so this takes it to the next level, which Omega really needs, not to just be this kind of cardboard cutout villain. And I think Collier is a big part of that. And I think the way that, yeah, Neve Fountain understands the way the character work really contributes towards that as well.
Yeah, Collier is, if Davison isn't, then Collier definitely is the MVP of this story. He gives a fantastic performance as Omega, and just the gravitas you bring from his voice at all times. I think my favorite moment, I'm going to say my favorite moment isn't one of the madness breakdowns, which are fantastic throughout, but I love the moment where the doctor, still not really the fake doctor that's half his personality, oh my god. Anyways, doesn't understand what's going on when Omega takes the sort of remote for the ship away from Sentia, and it's something to the effect of, that would ruin the magic, wouldn't it? And just sort of toying with this split personality he has, that he can't quite grasp at what's going on. And, like, there's a sort of, you can definitely see sort of a fear and sort of, like, almost impatience with him trying to deal with himself, but also sort of playfulness too. And that is so much fun to see him sort of embody all those emotions and just really have like a joy, Sarah, sinking your teeth into this material.
Well, absolutely. And you can tell that he's, you know, greatly enlivened by actually being given better material to work with as well. I'm sorry, I shouldn't keep beating down on Arc of Infinity, but it's terribly difficult not to. But no, I think you can see that there's a real desire to do something much more interesting with the character this time out in terms of the performance. And that's something that Ian Collier is able to kind of really bring up. And I think we'll get this as well. Next week, we've talked a couple of times, well, more than a couple of times, in fact, about the way that Big Finish is able to kind of resurrect, you know, usually companions from the TV show and sort of give them a new lease of life. And so we've talked about Nyssa and Perry and Mel and Adric. But we very rarely talk about it in terms of villains' performances. And I think one of the strengths of this trilogy, and particularly Omega and Davros, is that it really does help to give a couple of people who I don't want to say necessarily deserve better, because I think Terry Molloy does get some strong material during his run as Davros, but Ian Collier certainly doesn't, and it's great to see him have the opportunity to get his teeth into a role which is actually deserving of his skills. Arc of Infinity isn't deserving of anybody's skills, but here we have a script which really is, and you can just tell he's putting in so much effort to really deliver on a character that was otherwise, yeah, as you said, just a joke, just a sort of cardboard cutout, and it's just wonderful to see that. And as I say, I think we'll get that next week as well with Terry Molloy. I think Big Finish do really great things with Terry Molloy.
Oh yeah, Terry Molloy is just absolutely fantastic as Davros. Every time they pull him out, like, I think he's gotten a bad performance as Davros for Big Finish, which is so excellent. I guess we could talk about some of the other performances. There are not really many leave an impact, though I guess it is of note that we have a Bond girl playing Sentia. That's pretty fun. Carolyn Monroe.
Well, of course, she was always going to be the Doctor Who companion that never was. You know, she spent most of the 80s being told that she was going to be the companion in the Doctor Who movie that never arrived. So there's a wry amusement to her finally turning up in Doctor Who as a part where she's actually a companion to the bad guy rather than to the Doctor. That's kind of, there's a nice sort of meta humor there that's going on. But even without that, I think she gives a good performance to Sentia. I think she does well with the role, and it's not necessarily the one that has the widest sort of character parameters in this play, but she does a good job of going through the breakdown and her kind of unceasing devotion to Omega and what she's prepared to do to follow through on that. I think she's able to bring aspects of that character to life well.
She has a lot with a character that it really doesn't make much sense. I never really understood. I don't really understand the timeline with Omega, to be honest. Like, man, that would probably be because I haven't watched Arc Infinity in years and never intend to watch it again. But
lucky you.
Yeah, I don't know how it's he gets out of Amsterdam and then meets her, and then is it like right away he's on the ship and she fell in love in just like an instant? It's all very confusing to me. And then the fact that the whole dimensional instability leads to this sort of weird breakdown for her at the end also just confuses matters even more. It's a messy character, but one she does play very well. And like the first three episodes where she's sort of having to hide the fact that she knows the secret the whole time, like, it gets a great performance out of her, even if you don't know what's going on. But especially if you do, you can pick up on all these sort of different complex notes she's hitting with that performance, like clearly playing desperately in love with Omega, but having to hide it from the Doctor side of Omega and sort of dance around him. It's all very fascinating, and I love sort of seeing her enact that.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I agree with you. I think the timeline is a bit murky here. And I think that's another thing that the play can be rightly criticized for. I think it needs to land that a little bit better than it actually does. It's just a little bit too vague for it to be entirely convincing, I think. But I agree. I think she does give a good performance. And I really like Patrick Duggan in this as well. I think he gives a very nice performance. It's a very unpretentious performance. It's a very... well, low-key isn't quite the right word, but, you know, he's one of those characters who just is what he is, and he's happy to kind of get on with that. So, the rest of the cast is that, I mean, there's nobody really bad in it, but they don't particularly stand out. One thing I will say, though, is the two old biddies, that stagger around and then eventually turn out to be Time Lord agents. That is a nice conceit. I know we mentioned them a little bit earlier. But I think Faith Kent and Anita Ellis might do slightly too good of a job at playing annoying old ladies, because they are quite annoying. And it's like, I know that we get the twist at the end where actually it was all a big act and they turn out to be sort of significant. But it's still quite annoying having to listen to them, even when we get up to that sort of point. So that's a bit unfortunate, I guess. I mean, it's not a major flaw of the play or anything, but I would feel remiss if I didn't mention it in some way.
Yeah, I think Faith Kent does a great job. My estimation of her goes up even more when she does the turn and she's playing a completely different character after the reveal. And she does that opening and closing narration so lovely. And then, I know the jokes are hit and miss here, but I do love that very last grace note of, can I have your autograph? Just almost like, I don't know, it's sort of the kind of denigration the story deserves. It's because it's such a messy, like, sort of ugly kind of side to the story. We're talking about how history is by its nature going to do Omega wrong and do the Doctor more than he deserves. Just the can I have your autograph is just this perfect note of sort of an ugliness to it that I do kind of appreciate. But anyways, the Biddy stuff is very hack, and I think that does him disservice.
Well, actually, to just sort of address that point of the final line, I think it's got a bit of a sting to it as well, because it does suggest that, you know, we've had so much of the play which has been about kind of history and the perception of history and how we want history to be sort of more than just reduced to a series of, you know, plot points. They keep going on about Hearts in Orbit, you know, the soap opera, and there's a sort of quite an explicit paralleling between what would go on in a kind of hacky sitcom, a hacky soap opera, and, you know, the way that sort of events are being sort of portrayed as part of Time Lord history. That's quite a nice little parallel there. And then when we get to the end, when we get to that final can I have your autograph line, it's got a nice little sting in it, because it does suggest that even the people who are far more aware of the kind of the perception of history and the truth behind it critically are still kind of subject and bound to the same kind of flaws that everybody else is, that the same kind of mistakes that the people they've just been criticizing have been making. And that's nice. That gives it a nice little kicker. There's something, I've always found there's something slightly uncomfortable about the way that the Time Lords and sort of insist on a fixed arc in history. That feels uncomfortable, and that feels like something that the Doctor should push back against. But there's this, I like that final line. It's got just the right amount of bite to it to really kind of land the points from sort of the Time Lords right at the end. And that does, in my eyes, that makes all the annoying Biddy stuff worthwhile, even although it is still annoying.
This story really does have like a lot of dark bite to it. A lot of characters die, and especially in the case of Tarpov and Erkaitis, like, they don't deserve to at all. It's very much just sort of victims of this sort of awful circumstance and these sort of awful madness Omega is under that not even he is fully responsible for. And so, yeah, this is this very sort of dark sort of cloud over the story of this all, not only is all could have been avoided, it all just feels like sort of inevitable and no one's really at fault, and yet we just have to sort of keep going on past that. And I don't know if the story ever fully reckons with that side of it, but it does, like I said, it has a nice bite that gives it a good texture that is different from normal Doctor Who, which is interesting.
Well, and we even get a cameo from Zagreus as well. So talk about sort of, you know, adding that little bon mot, it's not really a bon mot, but adding that little sort of drop of future history into the mix as well. And I like the fact that it's not overplayed. It would be very easy to go, see what we've done here? Look, we've put this big thing up. But they don't. It's just a little cameo, and then it moves on. And that's fine. That's the right way to kind of handle that. If you want to have those kind of references dropped in or that kind of build forward, which, of course, I mean, it's only 3 months, really, before Zagreus would have been released, so it's perfectly fine. People are aware of what's coming up at that point. We've had, you know, I am Zagreus, you know, in the Doctor line. So it's fine that we have that little sort of drop in. I sort of quite like it, and I like the fact that it's just done subtly. There's no emphasis drawn to it.
as we're winding down, there's only really one major thing I want to bring up, and that's how dumb it is that Omega's name comes from a failing grade in Gallifreyan Academy. That's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
That is bad.
Yeah, that's the thing is, I think, generally speaking, this play does a really good job of balancing the fact that it is basically fan wank alongside the fact that you don't really need to have seen the third Doctor's, the three Doctors or Arc of Infinity to understand what's going on here. Your appreciation of the play is likely to be greater if you do know what goes on within those stories, but it's not critical to understanding the stories. That's fine. Mostly the play absolutely finds that balance between sort of, you know, fanish tendencies and actually being able to tell its own story. That one is the exception. How do we in any way benefit from understanding the name of where this character came from? It's so cheesy and ridiculous and just bad. No spoilers here, but the Han Solo Star Wars movie has just done exactly the same thing and to exactly the same result.
Oh, God. That might honestly trump Died of a Broken Heart as my least favorite moment in Star Wars canon. It is so bad. And, yeah, that's just a blanket rule for all writers. If you're a writer listening to this, please never explain where a name comes from unless you are really confident that is, like, actually interesting. And if you are, just lead with it up front. Don't try to, like, retroactively do anything with that because it always just looks very embarrassing.
Well, that's exactly what this is. It's a terrible mistake. It's only one, but it is such a clanger. I rolled my eyes so hard. I'd actually forgotten about it. I'd forgotten that was a reveal when I'd listened to it the first time. So I came back to it fresh all over again, and it was just as terrible as it was the first time round.
Yeah, well, besides that, looking at the Time Lord history that we do get from those flashbacks, though, it's not very enlightening, but it does give the story a little bit more of a, I guess, dramatic, like, importance to it, even if we don't really learn much. We have a new actor playing sort of Rassilon, adding to the dozen or so we have already. And it's sort of interesting, I guess, to get more little drips and drabs of insight of him.
Well, I think it's also interesting that Time Lord history is essentially here being framed as something that's in the past. I know it's specifically speaking about Rassilon and Omega, and of course they are in the past of the TV show, as well as Gallifrey's own literal past. But there's something about the way that the history of the Time Lords is being presented here that kind of, especially towards the end of episode 4, almost felt sort of post-Time Mori. There's a couple of times, I think it's one of the Time Lord ladies who sort of turns around and sort of said, oh yeah, you know, there are going to be dark times ahead, and the Doctor's name is going to be one that's, you know, relied upon to rally the troops in the finest hour, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing a bit here. But there's something about the way that Time Lord history is almost framed as a past event that it speaks of the new series in a way, and that's kind of really interesting. Obviously, that's not something that would have been present when this was written. It's certainly not the first time I listened to it, but it's kind of, yeah, it's I think it's interesting the way that there's this suggestion that the Time Lords are something who are now subject to history. They don't sit above it anymore, and not only are they subject to it, but they...
I wonder if Neve Fountain was thinking about the kind of similar, but also radically different Time War from the Eighth Doctor novels to bring this up again, which sort of formed the basis of Russell T. Davies' sort of own version of the Time War. I mean, obviously, you couldn't have been thinking about Russell T. Davies' version because Davies was pitching his reboot at the time of this. But yeah, it's that could be a basis, but otherwise, it's just remarkable sort of coincidence and foresight.
Oh yeah, I think it's just serendipity. I don't think there's anything in it. I mean, this was released in 2003, and the Eighth Doctor range was 3 or 4 years, I think, in the past when this was released, in terms of the sort of Time War and the enemy and all that kind of stuff. I think that was around, I want to say 1999 or something. I don't have the exact dates in front of me. But yeah, so I mean, it's possible, but I'm sure it is just serendipity. But it's one of those nice little serendipitous things that's worked out very well for this play.
Yeah, I guess this is a question I sort of want to pose. How do you think this works as like a 40th anniversary thing? Because this is what Omega and this whole Villains Trilogy and then Culminating Zagreus is all about, is that it's the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who. So similar to sort of the 20th season, it's bringing back old foes and sort of trying to make big statements about Doctor Who in all these stories. And I think, yeah, it does a good job about that. We talked before about how, like, it sort of brings a darker edge to the Doctor and really complicates sort of his morality a lot. And I think that really does sort of do a good job, like, interfacing with Who's history in an interesting way.
I think it's a 40th anniversary thing. I think it does find sort of interesting new ways to interrogate the character of the Doctor across all three of these plays. And again, as I sort of mentioned earlier, that feels like a worthwhile thing to do. This isn't just kind of the usual fan service, you know, hang out the bunting and get a few actors playing the Doctor together. This feels like more, I mean, I know we'll get that when we get to Zagreus, but still, this feels much more like the way that an anniversary maybe should be approached. There's obvious love and there's obvious appreciation for the show here, but it's not uncritical. And I think that's the difference. I mean, one key difference between this and sort of season 20 is that it seems to all intents and purposes that the fact that season 20 had a recurring villain in every story was just a coincidence. It was pointed out afterwards and then sort of retrofitted on to go, yeah, because it's the anniversary series. That's what we're meant to do. Whereas here, this is obviously intentional. You know, they're deliberately bringing these kind of characters, these kind of iconic characters from the show's past forward and using them as a lens to sort of interrogate the character of the Doctor. That feels like a worthwhile use of kind of this sort of 40th anniversary conceit. I may have a different story to tell when we get to Zagreus.
Well, let's leave that story for when we get there. Until then, you can send us an email at talkingwho2you@gmail.com. No emails this week, but if you send them, we will read them on air and give our commentary. Also, please like, rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever podcatcher you are using. And please follow us on Twitter at talkingwho2you. You can also follow me on Twitter at Kevyko. That is KevyKO.
Fantastic. Well, next week we are going to be approaching the second story in this trilogy, which means we are going to be dealing with Davros and Lance Parkin's take on him, the Sixth Doctor as well. So we're very much looking forward to getting stuck into the second one of these, and we hope that you're going to join us for it. But until then, keep talking.